give that shit up, you can concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Hi everybody, and welcome to a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Cullum, and my co-hosts, Massey and Paul. This is episode 8 of season 3. If it is your first time listening, I would advise to go back to the start and listen from episode 1, as we will refer to previous shows from time to time. This show does contain film spoilers, so if you have not yet seen the film, I would advise watching it first. It might help you understand a little bit better. And now for today's show, I hope you enjoy.
Today we are joined by Massey and Paul, as always. Welcome, lads.
How you doing, Cullum?
How are things?
Good. And I'm delighted to say we've got Mr. David Ford with us as well today. So, David, first of all, thanks very much for coming on.
That's great to be on, lads. And thanks for having me.
Thank you, Dave.
We're delighted. We're delighted to have you. And, like, look, I suppose everybody probably knows of you, but give us a 30-second rundown, I suppose, of your sporting career.
Jesus.
If you can do it in 30 seconds.
Here, no, I've got more clubs than Tiger Woods. So,
don't miss any, Dave. Don't miss any.
Yeah, I'm former Ireland international number one goalkeeper. Played 500 or 600 professional football games. I'm a father. I'm a brother. I'm currently a coach and mentor with my company, Pathfinder Coaching and Development. And yeah, proud Irishman. So. I live for coaching, I live for mentoring, and I love to see people getting ahead in their lives. So that's kind of where I'm at the moment, if that makes sense. That 30 seconds.
less, you had a few seconds left over, but we'll give that to the next person we have next week. Thanks very much.
You could have warned me you were doing that, I would have prepared something.
Right, thanks very much. Look, thanks very much for coming on. And I know, look, as I said, you've got a hectic schedule with all that, but you've chosen a film that I wasn't aware of, but ever since I watched it, I'm kind of gone back now going, I must read the book, because I presume the books usually are better than the films. But the film is called Peaceful Warrior. And what was your thinking behind choosing this as something to discuss?
I suppose let's kind of put a bit of context into it. It was when Mossy contacted me. Obviously, Mossy is one of my brother's best mates. And we go back a long way as well with our families. You know, my dad and Mossy's dad would have known each other quite well and worked with each other and various different things. And my dad would have done some work for Mossy's dad. So we would have played Gaelic football for St. Michael's back in Galway. And that would have been, you know, my first love, really, more so even than football. And then it came to a stage where, you know, you get to that place around 14, 15, you got to make a decision. Which code or which way you're gonna go, and I choose football at the time, which was a difficult decision to actually make because I love Gaelic football. So why I chose this was when Mossy contacted me, he gave me a context of what the podcast was about coaching, mentoring, about that sense of motivation and inspiration. And I thought back to the amount of coaches and mentors and teachers and various different people that had such huge influence on my career. And when my own mentor gave me that video to watch a few years back now and gave me the book to read, I thought, wow, that's very fascinating. And it captures the essence of the relationship between a coach and a coachee or a trainee or someone that wants to develop and progress themselves. And I just thought, I thought it's just a beautiful, beautiful story, even though it's years probably ahead of itself. And it was a, you know, I don't know, was it a C-class or a B-class movie? You know, people kind of watch it and think, wow, this isn't, it wasn't one of the biggest budgeted movies, but it's very heartfelt and it hits something and it strikes something with your soul. So that was the main reason why I watched it. And, there's a lot I can relate to within that as coming from a high performance background and that sense of, you know, that journey and destination.
Yeah, like I would have found myself that watching it, that I was trying to answer a lot of the questions that he was being asked. Do you know, like I said, one of them in particular stood out for me. We might talk about a bit further down was about finding the love in something you do, you know. And I was just kind of going, Jesus, I really love playing hurling. And no, I'm not any good at it. And I don't play at a high level and I've never played at a very high level. But I was thinking, I really enjoy playing it, but do the players that, let's say, play it at the inter-county level and high level in club, do they actually really love it, or are they just doing it because of an obligation? It was something they were good at and they were kind of kept kept doing, let's say.
A very valid point, and there is probably fragments of that in there. However, when you do get to, as you said, inter-county level, when you get to professional level, your mindset and your attitude actually changes, because the environment around you gets a lot intense, or gets very intense. And what you do is you find that you start to lose the joy and the fun in what you're actually doing. And you start to lose the love of what you actually did it for in the first place, because it becomes about, you know, what I want to achieve, what I want to get. And having those goals is really important. Setting those goals is really, really important. But then we can get overburdened with the pressures of success and winning and everything else. And then, like what we said, we lose the aspect of, why am I doing this in the first place? I'm doing it for the fun. I'm doing it for the sense of enjoyment. And then we can get uptight. We can get, you know, we can lose that sense of focus in what we're doing. I was always told, you know, love what you do and do what you love. And, you know, your life won't be too far wrong after that. Like, and it's a true thing, like, you know. So that's kind of my taking from that. And I'm sure the lads have probably, Mossy and Paul have probably experienced the same as well.
If you think about, say, your early part of your career, and if you saw this film where you came on, say, your sort of, you know, what you're doing now, if you learned about that a little bit earlier in your career, how do you think it would have went? If you get me, personally and then professionally.
Well, I felt I would have played for Liverpool or Man United, and that's fine, because I was my own greatest obstacle,
yeah.
And the amount of times I got myself into great positions and I sabotaged it because of my own low self-esteem. Because I was actually afraid and I was scared of going into the next stages and going on to the higher levels and the higher echelons.
Yeah.
So I definitely believe if I had that type of guidance and that type of mentorship, and that's not taken away from the people that got me to where I am. And you can look at it many different ways in the fact of, look, that's part of my journey. And even they touch on that journey about, you know, a sense of purpose. And that sense of purpose for me was understanding my journey, because I've always been a very sensitive man. I've always been a very deep man. I've always looked into things quite deeply, even since, you know, from such a small, as long as I can remember. So I was always fascinated by that sense of the human spirit and that sense of the journey of what we go on. And I always thought there was more to it. So from that aspect, there was a lot of correlations within that, within the movie and everything else. And in terms of, like what you said, in terms of what we can do when we, you know, maximize and fulfill our potential, when we start to take away what we're scared of and what we're afraid of, you know, when people start to, you know, it's really about the story we actually tell ourselves, and every story has 1,000 tales. And if we become, we either, you know, refine our own story, or we get defined by the stories others have of us. And that's basically what the story and the tale of the Peaceful Warrior actually details. It's about that story and what we can actually start, begin the narrative and the tale we tell ourselves.
Because, like, I remember playing a match with you, going out playing a match with you out to Connemara on a bus. You probably remember the day. Then Dave would have been a big...
That's not the day the referee had to run and drive off in the car, was it?
That's another day when we won't go down there. But we were going out to a match out in Connemara, out in Carn, or on the bus. And you were 19 years of age, because I would have been 17. And you were playing junior football in Galway. Now, a brilliant Hibs team. It was a fantastic junior team. And I remember you asking me, you said, Galway United are interested. Should I go up, or what do you think? You're asking a few different people. And they had a great keeper there, Eddie Hickey. And, like, it just shows you, you're sort of in doubt. Should you challenge yourself or push yourself at that stage of your life at 19 years of age?
Yeah, and I remember that well. And oftentimes, as you said, you go and you seek out counsel from various different sources and people you rely on and people you trust. And, you know, sometimes you hear what you want to hear. And sometimes, you know, when we hear what we don't want to hear, we don't take it on board. And oftentimes that's the best medicine we need to hear at that time and at that stage. But because of everything else that's kind of gone on for us in that space where we're like, I'm not too sure what will I actually do, we look for someone else to kind of empower us instead of actually empowering ourselves and actually going, well, right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go for it. And in the end, I just had to make that decision by myself. And say, right, I'm going to go up to Galway United, even though they had a great keeper in Eddie Hickey, and myself and Eddie stay in contact today. And he was fantastic. He was a fantastic goalkeeper. And I just had to believe in myself, because I always had a burning desire and a burning dream ever since that was probably ignited and sparked at Italy 90 when we beat Romania and Paddy Bonner saves that penalty. And that just went like boom in my mind. And I was like, Jesus, the Green Army, like, like, you know, Jesus, I'm one of Ireland's biggest fans, and now all of a sudden I get an opportunity to go and play for Ireland. So that was always my burning ambition. That was always my burning dream, was to go and play for Ireland. But along that period and along that path, that took so long, and it was, you know, so many ups and so many highs, and but more importantly, so many crushing lows. And you know, you look at throughout your career and you think, right, you've only had a certain amount of highs. There's been a lot more crushing lows than there has been highs. But you just get to that place in yourself and you start to actually realize, right, I have to go and do this by myself. I have to grab hold of this and grab the bull by the horns and believe in yourself, believe in your ability. When I was with my own mentor, I spoke to him about, you know, proving people wrong, and I was always out to prove people wrong. And he says, when are you going to start proving yourself right? I was like, had a Dan Millman moment where I fucking fell back onto the bed, just absolutely fell to the floor. And I was thinking, Jesus, that's actually insane. By just reframing and recalibrating something within my own mind. And like that, when you start to go, you start to see the power of the mind and stuff and where it can actually take it.
Yeah. Are you good? That's one of the things that's still unclear to me from watching the film is whether Dan had Sock as a mentor. And now this might be very clear within the book, but I'm unclear as to whether he had Sock as a mentor and he was a real person, or if this was him finally getting an understanding of himself and who he was and the direction he wanted to go. And like very early on in the film is like, there's obviously a lot there wrapped up in that athletic identity.
Layers in it. Yeah.
And like that athletic identity, and he defines himself as the gymnast. And the drink and the women and the crack and the status comes from that. It doesn't come from anything else in his life. But it's when it gets to the point where he's asked the question, what will you do if you don't make it? And I'm sure you've had that question has come for you at different stages, that it's only really yourself that can give the answer. It's the mentor can guide you, but it's you getting that understanding yourself of where it's actually going, you know. And it's the kind of film you probably need to watch two or three times to really grasp. Is it about, we'll say, an athlete mentor relationship, or is it about the athlete and their relationship with themselves and the different identities that they hold as an athlete? You know, it's,
yeah, there's a great saying, there's a great proverb in India, and they say, when the disciple is ready, the master appears. Yeah. And then there's another part onto that, and they say that when the disciple is ready, the master disappears. So when we start to understand many aspects of that, there's a duality to that as well, whereas we all have our own inner guide, we all have ourself in that space, our own intuition. And he says that when they're at the bar, drinking at the bar and having a little shot of whiskey. It's about having your own intuition and guiding yourself. But we function between instinct and intuition. And a lot of the times we often operate out of instinct for safety as a defense mechanism, where we won't go into our higher selves and that sense of intuition and guide what's actually coming to us and what's manifesting in front of us. And it'll stop us from making those moves and making those grooves. And then that's all really about understanding, you know, someone that can actually guide you into that place. And all someone is, when you find yourself a guide or a coach or mentor in that place, all they're really doing is bringing you closer to yourself. They're bringing you on a journey of self-discovery, and you start to discover parts of yourself that have been lost, parts of yourself that, you know, you start to call it soul retrieval, whatever word you want to put on that, where through hurts, through traumas, through whatever has happened in your life, whether it was, you know, something happened when you were at school, a school teacher or whatever happened to me. Manny got the old glontor over the head or whatever back in the day.
And you deserved it, I'd say.
Yourself. Yeah, probably I did deserve it. I did deserve it. But anyhow, so there's loads of times and loads of spaces, no more than when I was a young lad, you know, 13, 14 years of age, getting ready to go with my local football club, and all of a sudden being told I have to get off the bus because there was an incident before the week before, and there was a bit of a toe-to-toe, which I'd been known to get into in the past. And, you know, got me into more trouble than what it was. But I learned from it. And when I started to take the learning in it, then there was a whole different ballgame going on. So there was a lot of pain, a lot of hurt that I would have carried through. And what would have formed me and what would have forged me in my life. But going back to your point, you know, it's understanding that there is a duality in that. We're subjective in our nature, where we got our internal world and we got our objective world. And oftentimes, you know, people think that the journey is actually outward. The journey is actually in. But because of so much fears and insecurities, and he talks about through the movie, but not into that depth or not into those actually layers and into those things. So for me, my journey over the last 10, 11 years on my journey of self-development and personal self-discovery and personal development has been about that. I've used football, I used my life, I used all my experiences where I had to unlearn and relearn again to build that back up, knock down those defense mechanisms, those walls that I've actually had to transform myself and bring me into a safe. Because there was a lot of times I wasn't actually happy with myself. I wasn't actually happy with who I was. I wasn't exactly happy how I was and where I was and when I was. And whether that was with my wife and children and family, where I'd come home from training on often days and be totally, you know, I'd be physically there, but mentally I'd be gone out of the building. I wouldn't actually be there. So I wouldn't be present. So there was a lot of times in my life where I missed so many great opportunities with my wife and my children, with my friends, with my football, where it was always next. And that's the curse of a high performer, you know, because you're always thinking about the next game. You know, you're only as good as your last game, or you're only as good, you know, you're thinking about, right, I got the next game. I want to achieve. I want to get there. And then you all of a sudden you get to those places and you actually realize, wow, that wasn't what I thought it was going to be. Where we have a romantic idealism and we have all these thoughts of building it up or what we actually think it is. And then we get there. And then there's times where we do get there and they're absolutely peak experiences, absolutely amazing, amazing times. And then I start to discover, I said, right, there's actually something in this. There's something I'm missing out here. And then from once I started around 30, 31, and I started to look at that shadow side of myself, I started looking at those insecurities and fears that I actually had, then my performance levels changed. Then my performance levels of a father, as a husband, as a friend, as a businessman, as a footballer and as a goalkeeper changed, transformed. You know, all of a sudden then I get into Ireland at 31 years of age and I become the oldest player since World War II. I was going to say World War III. There's been a few of them. So, and then go on. And all of a sudden, that level of consistency started to come into my performance. And people used to always wonder, how did I actually get there? How did I get to that space? And that's how I got to that space. So I used myself as a laboratory, as a bit of a lab rat to explore those different philosophies, those different cultures, those different traditions. And especially as a proud Irishman, as I said, like, you know, that sense of Celtic warrior, what actually is that? How can I get in touch with that? How can I get more consistency in myself in those times and in those spaces and deal with that sense of pressure? Because to be Ireland number one requires big, big shoulders. Now, not only you think that, right, I come from my club football where you could have 2,000 to 3,000 people watching you, or 10,000 people, or 20,000. Now, all of a sudden, you're playing in the likes of Wembley with 90-something thousand people. Not only that, you're thinking, right, I've got 4 to 5 million people back at home, a few million of that watching it, how many people around the world? And now all of a sudden the focus just comes right in on top of you. And you're thinking, if you allow that to distract you, if you allow that to take away from your focus and concentration, it just totally dismantles you. It could absolutely just ruin you.
Going back to what you were saying there, Dave, like about being, I suppose, present. Like, it was one of the things that was said, Sock said, about being 100% devoted to the experience that you were having, the present. And as you said, like, for in elite sport, a lot of the time it's looking ahead, it's about the next thing and the next thing. And like what you can say, I'd imagine a lot of people can probably allude to what you were, or probably agree with the sentiment of what you were saying about just not being there in the mind. Like, and but for sport, like, you know, we talk about visualization and stuff an awful lot then. So, like, is there a small bit of a contradiction there for let's say someone listening to this now is going, you know, we get, or does it all fit in somewhere?
Yeah, it all fits in, as you said. It all just slots into the right place, because when you start to actually bring that balance and you start to bring that kind of sense of harmony into you, where you lose that sense of, well, you don't have enough, that you're less than, as Sock says in it, when you're less than or more than, then you start to actually realize, well, I'm in the right place now. That now, if I'm lacking something, you know, I feel like being deprived of something. And if I'm more than, then I feel that I've got more than somebody else. So then we can get arrogant and get complacent in that place. But then it's also important, as you said, to visualize what the actual experience is actually going to be. But a lot of the times we go into the visualization of the negative. We visualize what's going to actually go wrong. You know, I'm going out onto the pitch at the Aviva and I'm thinking, geez, what if a ball goes under my legs? Instead of actually thinking, you know, what if I save a penalty here tonight? Or what if I pull one out of the top corner? And there was times, you know, there was that times in my career where great nights and great moments, whether it was Germany or Sweden or whatever, I would have went into deep visualization practices, breath work, meditative states and stuff before I went out and played. And how that got me into the zone, got me into that, as you said, that flow state of that, right, I can channel my energy now into the right thing, into like a positive. And it's not even a positive. It's going from away from positive and negative. It's getting into a proper mindset. That's what I see it as a PMA, as a proper mindset, that you understand, right, that there is a negative and there is going to be a positive. But it's where we feel in ourselves and where we take that in that, with that sense of concentration and focus to that place.
If we're coaching an under 16, for example, or under 18, is there any way that we can help a player like that get that mind focus at an early age?
It's a maturity thing as well. And that's the thing. It is a maturity thing. And once is good habits. And that's what he speaks about in the program or in the movie, when he talks about habits and her habitual patterns. And, you know, as young kids, we coach them to get into good habits and perform in the right way. And ultimately, it's about making right choices, isn't it? Because when we make the right choices, then we come up with the right result and we take the right action and things. So when we get into young lads, I think the biggest thing with anyone that I've had as a young player grown up through the years and the coaches, you know, the likes of Joe Riley in Galway, an absolute hero, man way beyond his years and in terms of coaching, Tommy Lally. I've had some amazing coaches, Jimmy Brennan in at the Bish. My brothers were hugely inspirational to me as well. And understanding what unconditional support actually is and supporting people from that place, giving them that total support and, you know, giving them confidence.
And just come back to one of your brothers there. He told a good story about you when he was coaching, he did a bit of cycling. I was an under 12 Connacht championship or whatever, and you never cycled before, and he told you this is what you do. And was it Mark Scanlon who went on to be a future world underage champion, was in the race, and he's the bee's knees. So your brother Nigel was thinking, oh sure, just enjoy yourself coming up the final 200 meters. He looks around, there you are, dipping up your top, hands in the air, going over the finish line, winning it.
Yeah, I think it was down in Ennis or somewhere. It was Jimmy Hughes, remember Hughes's bike shop?
Oh, yeah.
Jimmy brought me down, and I was kind of the great unknown back then. Like, they were like, who's this lad? It's Nigel's brother or whatever. And I'm cycling for Thermal King. Next thing I get down to Ennis, anyhow, and I register and get me cycling license and stuff. And I'm thinking, Jesus, this is great. Anyhow, I don't know whether a mile or 2 miles or 5 miles. I don't even know how long it was. Anyhow, so we just thought we were just, you know, go or whatever. And I just took off like the clappers. And when I kept going, I don't know, was it just pure beginner's luck or enthusiasm or, you know, whatever that actually was. And I just put the head down and absolutely went for it. Next thing I found myself out in front, and, you know, couldn't believe it. Well, Jimmy Hughes thought I was the best thing since sliced bread. Like, you know, he brought me home and he brought me a Supermax and the whole lot. Like, you know, I got carted back to Galway. Like, you know, so that was some crack. It was some crack.
In fairness, there's actually, again, there's similarities between the film and that, because, like, you were in the moment in that you didn't particularly know what you're doing, but you have to do it at this. You have to do it at this particular stage, you know, and, like, in all sports, and even a coach or a manager operating on the line, they have to make decisions, and they mightn't have ever been in that scenario before. Look, the other team are doing X, Y, and Z, or they're doing whatever, and we haven't seen that before, and they have to make an adjustment and just go with it, you know.
Yeah, 100%. It's like Socrates when Dan says to him in the movie, he said, have you lost your mind? And he said, yeah, I lost my mind a long time ago. And it's when you lose that mind over matter, and when you don't, you know, when you lose your mind, you know, you just go into that space, as you said, you just start to focus and channel your energy. Then all of a sudden, interfering thought patterns and habits and all those things don't become don't interfere with your performance then. Those internal thoughts, the doubt or whatever else, am I doing the right thing? And you waste so much energy in that place that you lose, as you said, you lose your focus, you lose whatever it is. And when you get into that's the absolute flow state. That is the zone, you know, that's the zone. And, you know, whether that's an athlete or, and it takes time to train into that space, or whether you're a writer like me writing my book at the moment, or over the last number of years, I've got into spaces and zones of creativity that, you know, time stands still, or you come out of a space, and I'm sure you've all had it at work or wherever you do, where you've come out and you've actually gone, Jesus, where's the time gone? Was that 4 or 5 hours? No way, it couldn't actually be. Or there was times in games where, you know, I've made saves. I've gone into the absolute top corner and people have come up to me afterwards, and lads at the Den or at Millwall and stuff, and they're going, geez, that's the best live save I've ever seen. And I'm kind of looking at them going, I just dived and I just got my top hand to it and tipped it over and stuff, like, you know. Lads thought I was just being humble, but I actually genuinely didn't actually realise how good of a save it actually was. And then I go back later on and I go to the video analysis and he hands us a DVD or a VHS back in the day, and you slip it in the phone, you watch it and you rewind it. And next thing you're going, you watch it at real time and the speed and pace, when you're going, that did not feel like I was travelling at that speed or that pace at the time. So when we start to use the mind and we start to focus and concentrate it into the right place, when we become one pointed, then all else changes. So I was doing these things naturally, and these things as a young kid, and I was growing up and I was getting older, and I was thinking, right, how can I become more consistent with that? You know, these were just coming in fleeting pockets and fleeting moments. And one, you know, I've had so many experiences like that. And I firmly believe that the top players, the higher players, I believe that, you know, if you're to sit down with Messi and Ronaldo, I believe that they treat the game, it's nearly like a game console to them. They can slow down time and absolutely just see people coming and stuff. Because some of the things they do, you're just going, how have they actually done that? How have they done that? So whatever way their intuition or whatever way their makeup is or whatever else, they're just operating from a whole different dimension, a whole different sphere. I genuinely believe that.
So when you just say, when Harry Kane was with you at Millwall, could you see that he had something like he stayed back, did a lot of extra training and stuff? I heard believes taking shots in you and stuff like that. Could you see that he had something about him that would progress him to where he is now?
Harry's granddad's a Connemara man.
That's right, yeah. That. Yeah. And, Renville man.
A Renville man, yeah. So he was, Harry's tough as nails. He's the type of lad now, he's like one of those, do you remember those clowns when you were younger? The bag of sand at the bottom and you box and it comes back and hits you. You kick lumps out of him and you just keep getting back up. And you just look at me and you think, he was such a very humble lad and such a really nice kid. And he's the type of lad now that if he went and he played darts now, he'd be, you know, 180, he'd be hitting bullseye. Or he'd go play golf and he'd come in and say, what were you at yesterday? And he'd be like, oh yeah, I played golf. And I said, how'd you get on? Like, and he was like, I had about 10 under, but I wasn't really happy with that. Like, and you're kind of going, 10 over now at this stage. Like, yeah. So he always had a great ability for, he was like a sports billy, like, you know. And I definitely think he could have been, you know, he had that in his genetic makeup and stuff. But what he did have was his ability to finish. And when he got into those times of finishing and the pace and power he used to hit that ball at, where coming towards the end of my career at Cardiff, training with Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank. And Jimmy, I've never, like, thank God I only met him when he was 38, 39, because I hate to see him in his peak, because I used to come off and I'd have no elbows left. I swear to God, my wrists, my hands, my fingers, everything was sore. He used to absolutely pump that ball. You'd nearly be afraid of you thinking, Jesus, Jimmy's coming here, like, you know. And next year you're putting out a hand, you know you're going to save, and you're thinking, my hand could actually, I'm going to do damage, I'm going to do a ligament, I'm going to break a bone, I'm going to do something. And Harry had that ability as well, you know.
Dave, I don't feel sorry for you one bit, because I remember I used to be playing in corner forward and you'd be just booming in balls as hard and as high as you could from midfield, and it'd be just landing down on anybody. You just not want to be hit with it.
I just love centre midfield. I love playing centre midfield. I love the whole challenge of it. I love going for high balls. I love the rough and tumble of it. I love the skill element of it. I love the ball striking. Jeez, it's such an amazing sport. Like, it's such a class sport. Like,
Mossy, just so you don't get away with that. So you want perfect ball played into you when you're playing in the corner. and you won't win your own ball.
Well read, Paul. That was Mossy all over. He'd be like, I'll chuck out here on the old wings and, you know, feed off the Colin Murphy off Buddy.
Exactly.
That's all I had to do. Ball. Even Colin Murphy couldn't catch some of them big high balls you were kicking in. So that was snow on them. That's the expression. There was definitely snow on them.
And you were no fox in the box, no, Mossy. It's
well renowned that Mossy was an elite athlete back in his heyday. So our listeners are well aware of it at this stage.
he had the little drop the shoulder on the go. That was his number one move. Like, he thought he was Peter Canavan.
Probably his only move.
The only thing I had in common with Peter Canavan was his haircut, David.
Well, I'm glad you said that, not me.
There was just something in the movie that I thought, you know what, we actually talk about it an awful lot on this, about success is, for most people, is winning the cup or winning the title, whatever it is at the end of the year. And like it mentions in the movie about the journey, you know, the journey is what brings the happiness. And for a lot of people, I suppose for coaches, they're quantified on success. Their success is quantified on coming first or winning the cup or winning the title or whatever it is. But I thought it was actually a really simple way he did it in the movie when he said, we're going for this walk. I'm going to show you this. Wait till you get it. And then it's just a rock on the ground. Yeah. And like something so, so simple, but it just had such an impact, I'd imagine, for anyone watching it.
Yeah. As you said, he hadn't gone there with no expectation levels. And when he did get there, it was just using in a teaching tool. Because like that, and it showed him, it showed your man Dan that, right, I'd gone there with an expectation of seeing something beautiful or receiving a gift or whatever that is, or winning or success or whatever else. And then when he got there, it was actually the journey getting there. It was the fun he had with his mentor on that journey to get to that point, and the learning and what he got out of that, whatever he got, that was the beauty that's actually in it. And oftentimes we meet so many people in our lives and we journey with them. And then it's not till they're actually gone or we make those separations and distance, and you look back and you think, and especially now over COVID periods, you look back and you have that time to reflect and you think, geez, I had such a great time back then. I had great fun with that person. And that's just the way life happens. We get married, we have children, we move on, whatever it is, we move job, we move country or whatever else, and we lose that sense of connection. And I think, as you said, it's just a beautiful way to describe that. It was a really nice scene within the movie.
Yeah, because I know, I think it was Dave Duval when he eventually won his first major. I think he was nearly as good as retired about a year later, because the jubilation of winning, or what he expected it to be, the end product of winning a major, it didn't live up to it.
Yeah,
and like for him, it was he was very conscious of his own mind and body that, like, this isn't the height that I wanted. And it took him a long time to recover, but like it is something in sport where the pinnacle, like I'd imagine if you're a Mayo footballer, winning the All-Ireland football title is probably the greatest thing you could ever do. And it's the highlight of your life. But really, like, it's probably insignificant in when it's 70 years of age, when they look back on everything. Like, no, it'd obviously be lovely for them, but, you know, they can put too much scope on one thing, like.
Yeah, like what Mayo have achieved over the last number of years with the amount of finals they've got into and everything else has been absolutely amazing, absolutely phenomenal. And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that's had some crack as well, getting up to Dublin and getting up to Croke Park and getting to those finals and stuff. And then, as you said, just the whole disappointment of it. But as you said, I do think when they will go on to win it, and it's just a matter of time, they will do it eventually, it'll be all that more sweeter. And you know, it's so fascinating to watch that, as you said, how we view success and what success actually is. And success means so many things, different things to so many different people. But because we quantify it and we monopolize it or make it professional or whatever else, then it takes on a whole different, dimension to it. Like, you know, so it really is about understanding that kind of, right, I'm here for the fun and the joy of it, but yet I have to earn a living. You know, I'm still a professional athlete. I'm still getting paid to do my job. That's my actual job. So I have to be successful as well. Like, so it's like what he says at the end when he's doing on that journey. He said it's understanding the three principles in it. When he said, you know, one's a paradox. He said one is humor. And he said the other third one was change. And when we start to understand that, then we start to think, yeah, there is so many paradoxes and the great mystery of life. But we have to have a sense of humor around that and then be open to change. So there's a lot to it.
He was in the film, he'd say, a fraught relationship with his teammates. And I know there was a sort of a famous incident with yourself when you were playing with Barry, when you got sent off. You were sent off, weren't you?
I got 8 games, I think, yeah.
Eight games for fighting one of your own players, one of your teammates, I should say. How did you mend relationships, or was there a relationship to be rebuilt there between yourself and your teammates and your coaching staff, or was it just forgotten about?
I was gone to West Ham 2 days later. Never seen him again. Well, lads, if you're listening, I'm sorry. Hopefully we can have a pint about it in a few years. You know what I mean? But I totally get it. We were playing, and Ryan Casey, you know Ryan as well.
Yeah.
And my best mate Ryan, we grew up together, and Ryan went off to Swansea when he was 15, and that's a whole other story as well, like, you know. But Ryan was at Swansea, and just before he got injured and stuff, and Ryan scored the winning he scored the first penalty for Ireland under, was it the 17s or 18s?
18s, Robbie Keane's team, yeah. Wasn't it?
When they won the championship that time. And so next thing, we played on the Saturday, and I think we were second v first or first v second, whatever it was. And big pressure, big game, was coming up to Christmas. A few months previously, I'd lost my grandmother, and my grandmother was always someone very, I used to live with my granny and stay with her and everything else. Mm-hmm. She was an absolute hero of mine, like, you know. So when I, it was my first kind of, and I was always reluctant to move across to England, because I used to look at Ryan, I used to look at Tony Follin, Colin Hawkins, all the lads I would have played with up in Dublin as well, all that genre and era going across to England. And I would have thought, Jesus, I get a nosebleed if I go over to Corrib, never mind going up to Dublin, never mind going across to England, which was like, Jesus, this is so much sort of fear of that alone. But yet my ambition and my drive was to play for professional football and to play for Ireland. So there was such like contrast in it. There was so much internal turmoil within that, where it was like, I want to go, Jesus, you can't go. And it's like when he's on the top of the tower, when he's battling with his own ego, and you're with that, you're head to head, toe to toe with that, and you're just fighting with yourself, as I said, that everyone's greatest obstacle. And so we're playing away, or we're playing on the Saturday, and it's live on BBC Wales. And I'm still waiting for it to come up on Question of Sport one day. What happened next? I've been blessed, it hasn't. So anyhow, I'm there, and Lee Jarman, the centre-half, and he's a former Cardiff City centre-half. And we had a good side back then. Peter Nicholas was the manager. He was Chelsea, and Chelsea captain, Arsenal as well, I think, would have captained Wales. He was like an old-school ex, like an absolute lunatic he was, anyhow. Mm-hmm. And Kenny Brown was assistant manager. Kenny played for Norwich and West Ham and Millwall. And he's the head of coaching at Millwall at the moment. So Kenny then became manager. And we're playing the game on the Saturday. Next thing, live on telly, ball comes back to me. And it was a bit of a hospital pass from Lee Jarman. So I managed to get to the ball, just clear it. And I seen the tackle come in, studs up. Like, you know, it was a nasty tackle. Like, studs were up. Cleared the ball, and I managed to ride the tackle. You know, he caught me on the shin, but I managed to do a little 360, the gymnast that I am, you know, light and nimble on my feet. So I managed to ride the tackle, jump back up off my feet, and I'm going to Lee Jarman. I said, what do you think you're doing? Like, you know, you nearly broke my leg. It wasn't even a 60-40, it was an 80-20, right? So he comes over, and, you know, just in the height of the emotion of the game, everyone's all up for it. You know, family are watching the game. Half of Wales is watching the game. Do you know what I mean? And it was just a mad, mad evening. So he pushes me and he says, like, get out of me face. And I says, push me one more time and you're getting it. So he pushes me. Boom. Right into the jumps. Next thing, everyone's like, oh, what's absolutely going on here? Referee comes running over. Red card. And I just went, oh my God, what have I actually done? So next year I get the red card and everyone, I could just feel everyone disgusted with me. Like, who's this thug, a little hooligan, like, you know? So I grab me tail and I'm walking off the pitch, and now I'm lording the snake's belly at this stage because I was fucking it hard enough. I was struggling with a fair bit of depression myself because I was thinking, I'm 20 years of age, 21 I was, first time away from home. I'm missing my family, I'm missing my friends, and it was such a lonely time and lonely space. And I'm walking off the pitch and I'm thinking, what am I after actually doing here? So I'm in the change room after, and it's a long story, there's a lot to it. Anyhow, Ryan rings me that evening, like, you know, and he goes, I'm here with half the Swansea team watching the game, they all think you're an absolute lunatic. So brilliant. I don't know, was it a case of, I don't know, was it, did it actually enhance my career of, that's the type of goalkeeper we want?
So it wasn't a bad thing.
Yeah, so Kenny brought me in a couple of days later, and he was like, well, 2 days later, even the club doctor had to come and visit me. She was that worried, like, you know. And I was worried myself at the time. Looking back at it now, I can laugh, but it was no laughing joke back then, like, you know. I've gone in, and Kenny's called me into the office the next day. And that stage, there was a lot of clubs started to watch me. You know, and it's funny because all the clubs that were watching me, I've actually played for. So there was a lot of synchronicity. There was a lot of magic in that. And you know, when I sit down now and I'm writing a book now and I look back at the magic and the journey of that, it's amazing. It's amazing. So I'm so looking forward to getting that in my hand and getting it finished and getting it out there. But yeah, Kenny calls me into the office and he says, I'm going to find you. I'm going to have to find you 2 weeks' wages. And I was like, I'm going home. I'm leaving. I'm going back to Ireland. He goes, what do you mean you're leaving? He goes, no. He goes, whoa. I said, no, I'm leaving. I'm going back to Ireland. I've had enough. No. Look, I won't find you. And I said to the guy, what's actually happening here? What's happening? Next thing he's like, right. He picks up his phone. He got into massive panic because he knew well there was Coventry was watching. Even though I didn't play for Coventry, even though I said I played for Coventry, or all the clubs came
watching. Yeah.
Millwall were there, Portsmouth were there, West Ham were there. And I think even Luton or Bournemouth could have been there as well at the time. So he jumps on the phone and he says, look, he said, David suspended for 8 games. What do you reckon we should do? And he was like, well, why don't you bring him down to West Ham and train for a few days or a few weeks? I probably had about 8 weeks off, so I could have been down for a few months and gone missing. So he says, right, grab your stuff. You're going down to West Ham tomorrow. But there's a whole other raft to it and stuff like that. Like, so that's how mad my life and my career has actually been. You know, oftentimes I think it's been the worst thing in my life and it's been the best. Oftentimes I've done things and I've thought it's been the best thing in my life and it's been the absolute worst. So there's so much actually to it, and it's been, as I said,
it's all just learnings along the way, isn't it? Really, yeah, like anything, yeah, you just learn from it. Yeah. It's going to be a good book, David.
Well, I hope so, and it's something I've really enjoyed because I had two ghostwriters doing it initially, and this is something I started. When I started doing my own healing journey many years ago, you know, it was brought to me that I need to write a book. And out of my own, how small I felt in myself, I thought, who's going to want to read about David Ford? Like, who are you? What have you done? That's how small I used to see. I'd never seen the other side of it. And then when I started, you know, expressing it and talking about my story, and then the ghostwriters had the kind of stories and where they wanted to bring them, I was thinking, they're not capturing the essence that I want to bring to this story. I want to make this about, as you said, a journey, about an absolute experience, about an absolute adventure. It wasn't the kiss and tell story. It wasn't the sensationalized stories. It was just the story. It was just the journey. It is what it actually is. And I was kind of battling with myself in that. And then one morning I come in after doing my meditation and doing my breathing and my breath work and stuff like that. And I said, right, I'm going to, like that, your intuition, something just came, and that inner voice in my own head said, right, write it yourself. So I started writing it myself. And then about 2 years ago, when I set up the company and business and stuff, things got a bit hectic and I kind of shelved it a bit. So I got about 2/3 of it done. And just over the last number of weeks now, we've started to kind of get back into it and getting writing into it again, like, you know, and getting that kind of fun. But it was such a cathartic experience, you know, writing and journaling. and just the spaces that brought me into was phenomenal. It was absolutely amazing. It was such a class thing, and it was such a great experience to do. So I'm really looking forward to sharing that with people. And for me in it as well, you know, people often say, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to publish it? All that. And I said, well, look, if one person buys it and they get so much from it and they found it such a tool for them that they can implement certain parts into it, that's a success for me. I'm delighted with that. You know, it's not really about, you know, as we said, the success of it's not about sales or whatever it makes of it. It's just what people can actually gain from it. Because I started to realize that I have a story to tell, and I've been blessed with an ability to show that level of vulnerability, you know, that courage to be imperfect. Because, you know, I've made so many mistakes. I've made so many mistakes. And that's why, you know, I do what I do today, because I share that with young footballers. I share that with the corporate world. I share that with whoever, all walks of life. And that level of learning and that level of journeying. And it's like at the end of the movie with Dan Millman, in the end, when he starts to coach his own teammate, when he starts to bring him through his inner demons of what he's focusing on, his dad and everything else, when he gets him prepared and gets him into that right space. And that's really why I do what I do now, because I've been blessed, so blessed to have the experiences that I've actually had. And it's not a place of coming from the tale of woe where, oh, I've been this and I've been that, because I haven't. I've been blessed with so much on the other side. But getting onto that other side of it is a whole journey in itself.
Excellent. I was in a bit of a trance there listening to that.
I was just like, did my internet go again?
No, I had a question in my mind halfway through that, and as it just kept going, then I was just kind of, what was I thinking about there again?
It was answered, the question was answered.
Yeah,
but there's like, I know, like just going back to when you were younger and you signed with Galway United first, your mother has a great story about how
are you career... digging her own? Are you...
No.
Are you a journalist or a teacher?
And Donna Reardon arrives up in your house one day, knocking on the door, and you tell the story there.
I forgot. What's
that? And Don. I'll tell you now. Remind you so you can put it in your book. And the Galway United manager Davis, just after signing, comes up to bring him some goalkeeping training. Knocks on the door, and Dave's asleep up in the bunk bed upstairs. David's up in the bunk bed upstairs in the bed, and he was like, oh, there's Don Reardon, I'm going to go on training. And the mother covering you for downstairs, oh, he's gone out training hours ago. Are you upstairs in the room shouting down?
Where is he? Hey, Don, like, I'd still have an odd email and a text with Don and stuff, and Don was magic for Galway. Like, you know, he just brought a whole level of professionalism, because I was a pure amateur. Like, even when I went on to West Ham and I went on to other clubs, like, you know, I probably didn't turn professional until I was about 31, you know, even though I was in the game till for how many years. Yeah. And, you know, Don used to come up, arrive at the foot of the green at Inishanna Park there. Do you know where the big rock was at the bottom of the
Yeah.
And he'd pull up in the car, and he had a green Mondeo at the time, sponsored by Ford. And next thing you hear a little beep or whatever, next thing all he'd see was my curtains drawn, you know, the curtains, you know, getting my gear on. I'm going, he's waiting for me, the coach. And, you know, that's just how, you know, stupid I was and foolish I was at the time. Like, you know, but to be fair to him, he showed a lot of patience like that as well. He showed a lot of patience, and he understood that I needed that more, like what he said of it. You know, usually the ones that need it the most, you know, need love the most are the ones that are hurting the most. And he's seen that side of me. And Don, you know, he often says to me, and we used to have great conversations. And I remember sitting with him one day, and I know I'm going off the story or whatever else.
No.
Was just triggering me at the moment. And I said, what? I said, Don, what does it take to be a professional footballer? Don scored one of the best FA Cup goals. Was it 71 or 79 for Notts County against Spurs? At old the baseball grounds.
It pops up on BBC every year, so it does.
Yeah. You see him running off with his big absolute mullet barnet, like, you know. And I said, what does it take to be a professional footballer? And at this stage he was lining up trials to go to Derby County and stuff like that, because of his connection to Derby and Jim Smith and Eric Steele, the guru of goalkeeping, ex-Man United goalkeeping coach. And he said there's two things, David. And I was like, right, two things. Anyhow, nearly got me pen and paper. I think I'm waiting for these two things. I said, what's the first one, Don? He said, the first one, David, he said, is attitude. I was like, Jesus, yeah, attitude. I need to sort my attitude. Probably get out of bed a bit earlier in the morning and be waiting for you rather than you waiting for me. And I said, what's the second one done? And he said, the second one, David, he said, is attitude. I thought, that just blew my mind. I thought, whoa, that's actually amazing. So attitude is definitely a recipe for getting ahead.
Any other things in the film, lads?
The end of the film was like Sopranos-esque, where the screen just went blank, okay? And it didn't matter to me, did he make the jump? Did he not make the jump? It was the whole journey along the way. That was it. Like, the end result didn't matter, basically.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's like that, isn't it? You know, as they say, isn't it? Drive it like you stole it. You know, you only get one life, and life is for living, not existing. And when we get into that mood and we can become more present, we start to actually realize that, like, take for instance there, the beauty of that, you can come on a podcast this evening and your little one's sitting on your knee and we're all just having a crack and we're getting on with it. You know what I mean? Where it's just like, right, that's such a beautiful, beautiful thing to happen. Such a beautiful experience, you know, and it's the same with everything else. It's just like, Just enjoy it, have the fun, enjoy what it's actually doing. But if we can adopt the way of the warrior, that we can have total focus and concentration in everything that we actually do, then we become more present and we start to enjoy ourselves more rather than being tormented, as you said, by the outcome. You know, burdened, you know, whether it's, you know, we're burdened by the past or tormented by the future. And that's really what it's all about.
Paul?
Yeah, you know, another thing that kind of sticks out for me is like when he looked to go back and try and get it, be allowed to have the trial for the Olympics, and like the coach said no, and it was like, you gave up on me, you know, and to a large extent in a lot of sport, the player's fate is in a selection committee's hands or a manager's hands or whatever, you know. And no matter how well you do, it can be somebody else's decision whether you play or not, you know, or whether you're deemed good enough or not. And there's you can't allow another person's, a lot of the time it's an opinion. You can't allow another person's opinion define who you are and what you're about, you know?
Yeah, totally. And I totally agree with that. And as you said, there's luck involved, there's someone's opinion, there's someone's, their choices to have to, but it's how we respond. No, it's not how we react. And that's what he says, you know, he says the warrior responds, and he says the fool reacts. And it's understanding that we mightn't get it our way now, but there's going to be another game. Mm. So if we respond in the right way, now we're not getting lost in the disappointment of it. Now, all of a sudden, if I'm called on and I'm a real teammate and I'm a real team member, taking my individuality aside and becoming a team, and I was an ultimate team player, I love being in teams, and it was always about the team, is, well, how best can I support the team? How best can I take my what I want and my ambitions and my dreams for the team and the collective, for the greater good, for the greater of the team? That if I'm called upon after 10 minutes, someone could pull their hamstring. Someone could, you know, whatever, get dragged off at halftime. Now, am I going to be caught in the disappointment of not being selected for the first game? Or am I going to be in the right space and the right time that when I get my opportunity and get my chance that I'm going to tear the new one and set it alight? And that's what you see today. I've seen that so many times with footballers. I've seen it so many times they got dropped and this thing had been dropped. And even that terminology and the language around that is absolutely huge. Because now all of a sudden when they do get their chance and they get their opportunity, they don't avail of that chance and that opportunity. And then whether they've been sulking or in a bad mood or hurt, and people get hurt because of those decisions and understanding that. So there's a whole area of level of understanding that it takes, you know, a big time and a big space to get into.
Yeah, very good.
Brilliant.
Any last things to add before we give Mr. Socrates, as I said, like the film... Like, as Paul said at the start, like, it was kind of, a lot of time you're kind of scratching your head and you're kind of going, am I after missing something there? but like, I'd imagine the book is obviously, it goes into a bit more detail, does it?
Yeah, definitely. You'll always, I live for books. I love books.
Yeah.
I love reading. And there was a stage there where I couldn't read two pages. And then all of a sudden I got into my 30s and I thought, geez, I started hoovering them up. And like that, it is a good read. It is a good book. It's a good story. And like that, you know, whether, you know, you can always, as Paul said earlier, you know, you can revisit something once, twice, three times, and you'll always pick up something, something new for it. And that's the same thing, you know, you'll always revisit it and you'll only understand something for what's going on for you at that time in that situation. And you'll take that from the book and you'll use that going forward.
Colin, I think that's one of the points of the film. I don't think you're meant, we're meant to understand it. I think we're just meant to take it at that particular point in time, you know, because that's the way the way the world is, you know, that it's only ever right now, this is what you should do, but it's different in a different scenario down the line, you know. Like, people are always looking for the answers, but like one of the things in it was Socrates said, you need to ask better questions. So it's not about looking for the answers. It's about finding what the questions are, you know? And if you take that from a coaching perspective and you just start asking yourself better questions, you're going to improve as a coach rather than going to a course or listening to us. You're certainly not going to get any answers off us, but you're probably going to get lots of questions. And that's what it's about. Like,
yeah, totally. That's such a great show. Such a great show, as you said, asking better questions. And it is that, because when we don't ask better questions and ask closed questions, there's a lot of presumption in that. We're presuming and assuming on a lot of things. And it's coming from a lot of the times from a place of suspicion, and it's from a place of paranoia. And because that's been bred into us, and the way we actually do it, we're thinking, well, is he trying to do me over here? Can I trust him? Is he going to stitch me up? Is he going to drop me? Is he not going to play me? So if I get hurt in that kind of spaces, well, I'm just going to protect myself in that place. And I won't really open up and show myself in that. So when we start to learn that, when we start to learn about, you know, setting boundaries and setting that space for ourselves, then we can have, you know, if socially and with relationships with people, with coaches, with managers, we can enter into a different space then and into a different thing. And it's really like what you said, it depends on the story and the narrative that you want to tell yourself. And it's something that, as I said, you know, the story, I love a story, because a story unifies us, a story bonds us, and it's universal. And understanding those universal themes, whether you're a gymnast, whether you're a footballer, whether you're a plumber, whether you're a builder, bricklayer, whatever that actually is, and understanding that it is the great mystery and it is a great story, and understanding our own stories and who's the authority over that, who's the one that's going to govern and direct that. And you know, it's something that I'm very passionate about, and something that I'm running in the next couple of weeks. I'm doing a three series I suppose coaching sessions on the stories we tell ourselves, and looking at that, and identify certain layers and levels of that, and getting some tools and techniques and looking into those areas and stuff, because it is so fascinating, that inner voice. And as you said, it's which voice wins, you know. It depends on which one.
Where can we find this, David? Is it through your Pathfinder?
Yeah, I'll be sticking it up on social media. I'll be sticking it up on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and like that as well. I can send you on a link as well and stuff if you
do. Tell us a bit about the business there, David. So
Pathfinder Coaching and Development was like that. It's officially probably launched maybe 2 years ago, just after I retired, and it was something I was building towards like that over the last, as I said, 10-11 years. I started to look at, you know, doing a lot of healing work in myself. And you know, a wise man once said to me, he said, to heal something, he says, is to make it complete. And I started to realize that, you know, there was a lot of parts of myself that I didn't feel complete in. And I started to look at those areas. What are those? What is it I need to discover and find for myself? So whether that was therapy, philosophy, psychology, brought me on that path. And then I went back to when I went down to Portsmouth on loan that time, that I went back to study coaching and development. So I got my master's in coaching and development about a year and a half ago. I trained with the European Mentoring and Coaching Council and a senior practitioner with them. So, and plus just before COVID there kicked off last year, or last the middle of, when did I finish? July, August time, I just finished as the head of psychology with Crystal Palace Football Club. So whether that was working with players, coaches, players, whatever that actually, whoever was actually in the space at that time. And then working with corporates as well, you know, working with the likes of Bank of England, with UEFA, the FAI and stuff like that. Like, so I've been chipping away at those kind of things at the moment and stuff. And so things are really kind of ramping up, and I love working with people, and I love hearing their stories and their journeys and stuff like that, like, and seeing how best I can actually help and assist them. And then on the other side as well, there's the breath work I do every morning, Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. And it's an amazing practice. It is truly an amazing practice, just to fire you up, get your intentions and get your motivation and your clarity ready for the day. And plus build on that energetic level and stuff like that. And then in I think it's the 27th, the 6th and the 13th, those three talks will be held each Saturday at 11 a.m. And so look, if I'd love to hear from people, please feel free to connect, reach out, whether that's Instagram or Facebook, or if they want to email me at david@pathfindercoaching.ie, I'd love to hear from them and you know, shoot the breeze, and be great to have you on board.
Brilliant.
I think we leave it at that, David. Thanks very much for your time. Really, thanks, really appreciate it.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Huge amount of learning. As I said, look, we love this. We love kind of just looking at films and seeing what we can get out of it. And as I said, it was a slightly different slant in it, but it was definitely enlightening. So thanks very much, and best of luck with the business and everything going forward.
Nice one, Colin.
Thanks, David.
Thanks for joining us today. Please leave a review on your favourite platform, and if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. You may also want to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Roy Orbison Tattoo, and we appreciate any likes, retweets and comments or suggestions for future viewings. Next week, we will be watching Take the Ball, Pass the Ball, and we will have James Scott on the show with us, and it's available first thing Tuesday morning, as always. Thanks, everybody.